This is an interview with Alan Levine from the New Media Consortium.
So thanks for making time to talk with me at the moment, Alan. I know you're really busy getting ready.
That's okay. It's good to talk to people. And, you know, you can't work all the time.
Well, it looks like you do, actually.
it's an illusion, but yeah, I do put in some long hours. New Media Consortium is a membership organization. We have about 250 organizations that belong, and they are mostly people in higher education, but we have a number of members from museums, museum educators, a couple research institutions, and a couple special projects, and it's all people who are interested in, you know, furthering what we can do in education and creative expression with new technologies. And it actually began back in the 90s, kind of when the era of first, you know, kind of CD-ROM multimedia came out, and there was a kind of a high-powered meeting in Japan with a lot of industry leaders, and they really recognized that this technology was coming to the horizon, and in the U.S. at least, there wasn't really a place or anybody really kind of ramping up what the kind of the educational opportunities, and they wanted to sort of create some seed places where new media would be taught, created, and generated. So it really evolved in the beginning around the starting of what were called, it used to be called New Media Centers, and there were 12 initial members organizations. And at that time, people like Sony and Apple, I can't remember some of the other charter industry members, they put a lot of money into setting up kind of, you know, these places at colleges where there'd be a lot of, you know, computers and software, et cetera, for creating multimedia. And it's evolved quite a lot since then to be less focused on kind of the tools and more about what we do with them. So what we do now is we have a number of major initiatives, and we run a number of face-to-face conferences, online conferences, and we do a couple regular projects, one of which I'll be talking about is the Horizon Project on emerging technologies. And we've had other ones. We've had an open source software development project called Pachyderm, which is a web-based multimedia authoring tool that kind of grew out of the museum space and is just now starting to really ramp up. And then we get involved with kind of new initiatives, like we've been heavily involved in Second Life for the last 18 months or so. Not particularly Second Life itself, that's what we're using now, but more because we've had a long-standing interest in the potential virtual worlds as a place for collaboration and sort of new forms of expression.
So tell us a little bit about the Horizon Project.
It began in 2004 as sort of an effort to help people, you know, who are in our membership, but the, you know, the audience of teaching and learning in general, kind of continually take a look and scan at the horizon of emerging technologies. And it's not as much to be as predictive as some, you know, as the Gartner group, which tries to chart the trends of certain technology. It's more to try and go through the process and identify the technologies or issues that are going to be important to a significant number of people in higher education on three time frames, a 1 to 2 year, a 3 to 4 year, and a 4 to 5 year time frame. So there's a group of about 30 education and industry experts who start work in August and develop sort of a huge list of possibilities, which are based upon their work, a bunch of research. We look at a whole bunch of other emerging technology reports, and it gets distilled down to 6 things that we put on these horizons, 2 on each of the horizons, and we publish a paper document that gets released every January. And then we also make it available through Creative Commons licensing on our website because we want to see it get widely used. And every year we have usually more than 20,000 downloads of it.
That's amazing. And it must be hard, though. Like, if you look back at some of your earlier Horizon reports, do you think you got them right, the predictions?
No, and that's you know, an interesting aspect I'm going to try to talk about. It's almost not about being right, it's about even having these conversations, because there's more to it than just picking the right thing. It's looking at what are the trends and challenges. You know, why is this important now for education? So actually, I was just working on kind of a graphic which represents the last 4 years' reports, and I put all the you know, the items on the horizons to, you know, try to identify some trends. And if you go back to that first year, there was things like learning objects, you know, which was a big buzz back then. That one didn't really go far. At that time, SVG graphics had a lot of potential. That was right before Flash really ramped up. So sometimes, you know, things get eclipsed. That was my first year. I was on the advisory board when I was not working with NMC, but I was with an NMC member organization. And one of the items on there that, you know, I really scratched my head at, but it was this thing called rapid prototyping. And it's these 3D printers, which can, you know, take 3D models and actually render through a casting technology an actual physical 3D object. And I kind of understood the rationale, but I really... Wow, is this really going to be mainstream? Is this going to be big? And it hasn't really gotten big, but I've been in a number of places that actually have these. Sometimes they're in art departments. Down at the University of Texas, they have a lab called Digimorphs, and they're actually working with people in X-ray, but at a much higher degree, of objects like fossils, old parchment that are so fragile you can't really open it. And they use this 3D technology to actually create a model of it, and then they're able to actually print real-life objects based upon these scans. So they actually had one that was a dinosaur egg, I think from Mongolia. They really couldn't open it up because it's kind of precious, but by doing this scan and then casting this model, they actually identify parts inside of part of the fossil bird. It was pretty amazing. So that was one I bought into, you know. So it's not anything that had a significant impact on teaching and learning, but it is being used at a number of places.
When I look at where you've come from, you've been involved with the, you know, the web and the internet for a very, very long time. You must sit back right at the moment and think how much it's changed. Do you stop and think that?
Oh, quite a bit. You know, in fact, you know, you and I were just earlier watching this kind of impromptu live video broadcast from a bunch of U.S. educators on Ustream TV. I would have never really guessed that, you know, you could have high quality free broadcast video over the web. It's just utterly amazing, and all the, you know, the content creation tools that are available now. So I'm happily amazed, and that's what keeps me going, is that kind of thrill of discovery and being amazed. It jazzes me.
Is it, which it's now developing, amazing you even more than it did in the early days?
Yeah, it is, because it actually, you know, kind of looking way back to, you know, I started in 93 with the web, and, you know, it was intriguing, but I guess, you know, the rate at which, you know, new developments came out, it was probably not as rapid as it is today, which is one of the presentations I'll be doing at a number of my stops in Australia. It's not exactly like presenting you some really wow, flashy new insights. It's more about my take on living and dealing with this technology, and it's the one I call being there. And it's really about, you know, how we approach technology and, you know, how the first reaction is. My concept for this presentation really came out of my experience last year in kind of my first forays with Twitter. And like many people, when I first heard about it and saw it and thought, that's really the stupidest thing I ever heard about. Why would anybody do that? And it's easy, and you see a lot of people do that, to make those judgments from the outside without being there with the technology. And there's a confusion we make as well at confusing the capability and potential of a technology with actually the content that's being produced on it. So, yeah, a lot of people do silly, inane things on there. But when you look at the communication aspects of it, its ability to interface with the web, with your mobile phone, and kind of having this almost near real-time connectivity. I don't want to give away too much of my presentation, but it's more or less, you know, just my call for us to be open to the possibilities about what this stuff can do, and give up this kind of notion that we can quote unquote be experts in this stuff, and we can't. We need a network of experts.
And going back to that, I mean, people like me, it's really easy. I've already bought into it, but you know, there's so many people out there that are just starting out. And it can be overwhelming if we show them everything. So what advice would you give to, you know, get them in but without overwhelming them?
Avoid the fire hose. I've done this myself, and I've seen other people do it, where you try to wow people with hitting them with so many new things at once. And my strategy has always been in working with faculty especially, is to hit them where they live, which is what they care about, is their subject or their discipline. So it's a matter of finding something small that might set off a light bulb that's really relevant to what they do. Or the other aspect is just think about what's really important to people that they can really click with. And I always fall back on Flickr, because nearly everybody has some experience or has some practice of taking photographs or enjoying looking at photographs or sharing photographs. I mean, photographs are very meaningful to us. They're markers for our lives. And for many people, it's how we express ourselves. It's how we mark the milestones in our life. Digital photography and all the things you can do it is a great entryway for people.
So you like to go for the personal buy-in first before you sort of get the sort of buy-in as to why you should be using it with students?
Oh, it depends. I really, honestly don't. I think we make too many artificial distinctions between that, because, you know, what we do personally and what we do teaching and learning are slowly merging together. And, you know, I don't think it's always necessary to make, you know, you're crossing this line, you're going from life to school, and you have to leave one on the outside door. So, you know, there's things we do in learning that are relevant to our lives, and there's things we do in our lives that are relevant to learning. So it's not to say I'm just going to, you know, focus on solely the personal. It's just different people are going to have different hooks, and you know, some people aren't going to get it. So, you know, I might try a variety of approaches, but you know when that light bulb goes off on some people, and sometimes you're not there for it. So a lot of times you may do a workshop and feel like, wow, those people were hating me. I really missed the mark. But sometimes there's a couple of them that'll contact you later that said, you know, I really had to go back and think about this, or I had to try, or I had to talk about this with someone else, or, you know, I got this idea based upon something that you did. And sometimes you just won't know. So, you know, you can't please all the people all the time.
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard one, as you said, because the you know, it can be such a long-term uptake before you see them doing something that can be quite frustrating.
A lot of the, you know, approaches, if you really want to, you know, focus on the teaching and learning, again, is I think the avenue is use the tools to help them either find or do something relevant to their subject matter. Because, you know, I can come in and show you all this really groovy stuff with geology or volcanoes, and it doesn't mean anything to you if you're an English teacher or, you know, you're an aquaculture teacher. And it's hard to do in a group, you know, so you have to think about how can I set this up so people can go about and have some discovery in their subject area.
I mean, my biggest thing is I always get is I don't have time. You know, people will say I don't have time, and I noticed one of your comments on your blog was that you know people keep telling you that technology will save you time.
Yeah, that's they're lying.
I know that, but I was trying to keep that a secret.
Oh well, I think we're hurting our industry, because then people, you know, say later, well, I went to this workshop and they said it was going to save time, and I've been wasting more time. There's an investment of time, and I think we need to be honest about that. So. You know, and people will continue, I think, investing if they start to see some payback. The only exception I'll make that I say will save you time, in my mind, the one thing is you getting set up to get your information via RSS and a newsreader. Now, the pitfall is you get so excited you will consume more time because you keep finding things. But in terms of a shift from getting your information from back and forth of emails, which is very time intensive, and frankly, people put a lot of time into email for things that can be done more efficiently through some other tools.
Yeah, I like that, the business with the RSS, because I always go, oh, I should add this person because I'll feel bad if I don't add them.
Yeah, like they know it, you know?
Well, sometimes they do, though.
Yeah, they do. Well, you get over that, you know?
Yeah, you would. You would. But, so each of the different locations you're coming to in Australia, which is sort of being sort of sponsored by the Australian Flexible Learning Framework, am I right there?
Correct. They're the ones who invited me. I had some connections with them going back to my first visit in Australia in 2000, where I was working for a community college system at the time, and I got to take a 6-month sabbatical. And rather than taking classes or doing something like that, I said, I want to go to Australia and New Zealand and connect with educators. And so I made some contacts with some people in the TAFE system, and I got to participate. I think they had an online conference that year, actually through WebCT, I think. Mostly kind of visited people mostly in New South Wales, Adelaide, Melbourne, and up in Brisbane. Did a few presentations. And then I got invited in 2001 to do a workshop for the kickoff or induction for the flexible learning leaders. And I've stayed in contact with a fair number of my Australian contacts. And, you know, I consider them valuable parts of my network. So I followed last year as Nancy White, who I know from here, you know, got her chance to travel around the States. And I was rather honored when they contacted me and said, do you want to be this year's Nancy White? And I said, well, yeah, the trip sounds good, but I can't do what Nancy does.
So what you're saying is you're going to be wearing a dress.
Yeah, right. No, Nancy's marvelous, and I just respect so much what she does.
I noticed with your schedule that you're going to be probably doing different things in different cities. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, the way we kind of went through this is I worked with the, you know, the folks at the Flexible Learning Framework, and you know, we brainstorm a bunch of topics, and they kind of help me narrow it down. And I kind of put them out there with some real general descriptions on a wiki and kind of asked people to come in and pick and choose what they thought was interesting. So some of these, most of these are brand new, so they've never been done before. In fact, they're so new, they're kind of still on my computer somewhere.
but pretty much almost every city is something slightly different.
Yeah, there is a variation. In some cases, they wanted, you know, more time for one session. But kind of the main ones are my Being There presentation, which is kind of just get the people talking about technology and how we face it. I'm doing one on virtual worlds, which is, you know, as you know, you just got into Second Life, but there's a lot more to virtual worlds. It's kind of just coming up as an up-and-coming technology. And
I'm a bit freaked out by the whole Second Life business.
Oh, yeah. Well, it is kind of a freaky thing, but
I'm a bit worried when they say, you know, if you're going to strip off, you need to worry about getting skin.
I was just having a conversation with one of my other Second Life colleagues, and she was telling me, you know, about an incident where, you know, there was a presentation going on and somebody was suddenly naked. And I just thought it was so ironic that we would get so bent out of shape, because it's not us who's naked. It's a cartoon, you know, it's pixels. But that tells you how real the kind of the connection is there, that we would get embarrassed. There's an emotion connectivity that happens. You bump into someone, you know, your avatar, you know, you're walking around and you accidentally bump into someone and they get bopped back a few spaces. You're like, you apologize. And you're very aware of your physical space as much as you are in an elevator. There's something there really powerful about the social presence in virtual worlds. So I'll be doing a presentation on that kind of promise and perils, I think I called it.
So it sounds like you're going to be really busy.
Yeah, this was really an insane thing I volunteered for, because when they approached me, they said, oh, it'd be really great to come over for 5 weeks, and I would love that, because I didn't get to Western Australia or Northern Australia last time. I didn't get to the interior, and I'm not this time, but what happened was is that I've been with NMC a year and a half, so I don't really have a lot of leave saved up, and plus we had two conferences, one in late September, one in early November. And then my wife wasn't too happy with me being gone for 3 weeks. So I kind of came back and said, you know, I really can't do it for that long. I'd really like to. And they said, well, what if we cram it into 2 weeks? And I checked with my boss and she said, okay. And then I said, okay, I'll give that a try. And now as it's getting closer and kind of looking at that schedule of kind of being in a different city every night, it'll be quite a ride. But you know, I'm coming there to meet and interact with people. So if I don't sleep, you know, I can do that when I get home.
Sounds cool. And so, if people want to check out your schedule, where can they go to?
They can go. I've kind of got my stuff spread. The main place is a WordPress blog that I have, which is Cogdogroo, Cogdogroo. www.blogtalk.wordpress.com. And I'll be pretty much, you know, blogging what I'm doing as I go there. And there's a link there on a calendar. So that's probably the best place to go.
And they, so they can check that out, and they can contact the Australian Flexible Learning Framework in their state to book into the sessions.
That's correct. I'm trying to think if I have all the contacts there. I might have to update my list. You know, I know pretty much, you want to hear the trip?
Yeah, I've seen the trip on the blog.
Yeah,
I'm exhausted just looking at it.
Is it crazy? Yeah, well, you know, I start.
It's absolutely crazy.
Well,
I'm exhausted.
Yeah, well, like I told you earlier, I just need coffee, and I get energized by meeting people, and I'm really excited. My first one is in Tasmania, where I didn't get to before, so I'm actually going a few days earlier to kind of relax and rest, and I'll be visiting with Joe Murray there, who nicely enough invited me to stay at her home. And then I'll present there. I go to Melbourne and part of their VISTA meeting. Which is kind of held, it's at the same time as MLearn. It's not directly associated with MLearn. And then I'm up to...
It's actually just before MLearn.
Okay.
So it's part of the pre-conferences for MLearn.
Right. And I know there's going to be a lot of people coming to Melbourne for that. And I may just miss them because I leave Wednesday morning.
And I'm looking at it. And you, while you're at it, you're also doing a keynote for the K-12 online.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Is that crazy or what?
Yeah, well, the K-12 online conference is it's not a live keynote. Basically, my colleagues and I are recording something, and it gets released that week.
Okay.
So I'm not actually, like, physically present, although they have a live event later the following week when I'll be in Adelaide. So I go to Sydney, and it's part of a meeting they have there where I think it's an innovation meeting on. And then I go to Canberra, and then I get to Adelaide on the weekend, and Monday morning I present in Adelaide, and hop on a plane and get out to Perth Monday night, and Tuesday I present at your regional event at State, and then I have to, unfortunately, I'm really disappointed that I opted for, that I saw that, because I really wanted to get to see a little bit of Perth. Just the remoteness of it actually attracts me. And I go up to Darwin for a short stint, and then over to Brisbane. And then I'm actually going to go back to Sydney for my last 3 days and visit with some colleagues there and try to unwind.
Yeah, I'm tired.
You know how these things are when you're kind of planning them, that you're all excited about it. You're not really thinking about, you know, packing, unpacking your suitcase and spending hours on a plane. But it's okay.
It sounds like it's going to be fun.
Yes, that's what it will be.
Definitely fun. And hopefully I'll catch up with you in Melbourne.
Absolutely. I'm counting on it.
Okay. Well, thanks for your time.